I can see the connections between local fibers and textile products, and especially the idea of like reshoring, bringing production back, slow fashion, all these sorts of things really do relate to fiber, which if you're doing it in a very like local, sustainable way, should be coming from your area. So I think there's definitely a lot of opportunity. We're hoping to actually take our alligator project into the egg tourism realm and look at tourist items. It's another avenue that really hasn't been explored. But yeah, in general, like, it's amazing how many people I will talk to and say, oh yeah, I'm over in the College of Egg. And they're like, why?
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Casey Stannard, an esteemed associate professor whose expertise lies in the fascinating intersection of apparel design, sustainable fashion, and the psychological impacts of dress and appearance. Dr. Stannard's academic journey led her from Washington State University for her bachelor's degree to Colorado State University, where she earned her Master's of Science in Design and Merchandising, then to Oregon State University, where she completed her doctorate in Design and Human Environments. At the core of her research are the roles of traditional textile handcrafts in modern society, the social psychological aspects of appearance and apparel and dress, and innovative sustainable apparel design strategies. Dr. Stannard's work challenges the norms of the fashion industry by exploring new markets such as wild alligator leather, integrating wearable art and functional apparel design with technology, such as wearable exoskeletons, and pushing the boundaries of sustainable fashion through creative scholarship and theory-based design. Beyond her research, Dr. Stannard is shaping the next generation of fashion designers through her courses at Louisiana State University, which include flat pattern design, couture embellishment techniques, and apparel design through draping, to name a few. Her dedication to exploring and teaching about socio-psychological aspects of dress, appearance, and fashion, and her innovative approach to sustainable design make her a leading voice in apparel design. Join us as we uncover the depth of Dr. Stannard's research, her passion for integrating traditional crafts in contemporary contexts, and her visionary work in sustainable and functional apparel design. Let's delve into a conversation that weaves together the threads of creativity, sustainability, and innovation and fashion and apparel design. Welcome to Innovation Insights, Casey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have you here. I've known you for a long time. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. I am fortunate to have worked with you on your master's degree, and I just remember the days when you used to show up to my office door during my office hours every week for a full semester. And then at the end, you asked me, would you be my advisor? And I was like, yes, of course. And it's just been a joy to watch you evolve as a scholar and a leader within our discipline. And I'm so proud of you for all the work that you've done.
Thank you. It's been a wild ride, and I've enjoyed it.
When you start off by sharing with us your journey and what has led you to really focus on apparel design and sustainability and social psychology, and then also you have some really defining work in traditional crafts and the importance of that in people's lives.
Yeah, so really, this full career pathway has started very early for me. I come from a long line of crafty ladies. My grandmother was a seamstress. and all of her sisters, there were 10 children, were very crafty and good at different things like that. It was something that was really raised with. I started sewing when I was 5. So I was always tinkering in the sewing room and just playing and doing things. Now I say sewing room, but really it was like an unfinished laundry room that had a sewing machine in it. But that was really one of my favorite places to be. As I was growing up, I always really enjoyed putting things together. I enjoyed history and learning about cultures and different places. So I always thought that was interesting. When I was in 6th grade, I had gotten to this point where I was a little better at sewing than my mom. And I wanted to learn more, but she didn't know how to teach me. And at that time, grandma had retired from sewing. She wasn't wanting to sew anymore. And so my mom got the brilliant idea of finding a 4-H club for me so I could learn how to do some more advanced skills. So I joined the 4-H club. And when I got there, they had this wonderful teacher, Leslie Sprouse, and she was teaching silk ribbon embroidery, knitting, and cross stitch. And I said, oh my gosh, sign me up for all three. I want to learn all this. Beautiful. Great. Love it. So I started with that. And then I come to realize that, oh, at Leslie's house, you can have a lamb. And I said, oh, wouldn't be really cool to have a lamb. I want to have a lamb. So I ended up with this like market lamb project as well. And so I'm doing all these sewing things. I've got like my sheep over there and it was a great time. So I continued on with that, just learning about different types of handcrafts. Every year we would talk Leslie into a new project. We'd be like, Leslie, we really want to learn to do this type of handwork or this type of handwork. Each year we ignore on into something new. And we continued to have lambs. In the year 2000, I was actually the grand champion of the market lamb category. So that was pretty fun. But I also learned an appreciation for wool. I was like, pretty cool. I like it. So I was pretty into that fiber. So I continued on. When I got to high school, I started doing some work for the theater group. I think most of the people in the apparel design space have done some costuming at some point in time because they find out you know how to sew. And next thing you know, you're making costumes. So I was like, all right, this is interesting too. So I did some of that. And then I was getting ready to go to college and I really wanted to do something with design. I thought I wanted to go into architecture. So that's what I started out as. I was like, okay, it's design, but it's a little more structured. This is going to work great. And I did one semester in it. And I came back for second semester and I was like, I got in trouble last semester because I was putting clothing on my peeps. That's what they call the people in your architectural rendering. My peeps had knee socks and pea coats. And I was like, I think this might be a sign that I need to change my major. So I went over to the AMDT department and I spoke to Linda Arthur and she was talking to me and she's like, okay, well, you know, you're interested. That's cool. Do you sew? I'm like, yeah, of course. Isn't everyone here? And she was like, no. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Well, yeah. Through that first initial conversation at the end, she goes, oh, you're going to be a star. I'm like, that's so neat. Okay. So I started over there and it was really fun. I had a great time in my courses. I spent a lot of time with some really influential professors. I'm Dr. Arthur, now Bradley. I spent a lot of time with Joan Anderson, who was really great. And then Carol Saluso, who just such a funny lady. She was always telling us, you know, you just got to put it on the human, get it on that human, throw the fabric at the form. So I tried to learn this sort of like approach of, okay, just get it on there and make it work. It's going to be fine. So I tried to incorporate that as I was moving forward. When I was there, I actually was, I think, the vice president of our student chapter of ITAA, which we still had. I don't know if that was actually technically allowed by the larger ITAA, but that's okay.
Yeah. It was.
Oh,
it okay. was. Because Carol, I remember Carol fighting for students to be involved in ITAA. And so you were at the foundation of what now is even the graduate student organization.
Oh, okay. Well, that's wonderful to know because I remember being in that club and in 2007, they actually sent me and my friend to the meeting in Los Angeles. And when I was there, I was like, this research stuff seems pretty cool and this is exciting. And we were kind of going around and sort of stalking the different people that we knew had grad schools. And Mary Luttrell was so kind to sit down with me and talk to me about Colorado State. So I was like, oh, this sounds perfect. Let's move to Colorado. So that was the next step, is, you know, packing up my bags and moving down to Colorado. And that was really the next stage of my like design evolution. I still wanted to be in design, and I was very much still doing all my design stuff, but I was also getting really interested in knitting. I had been doing a lot of hand knitting in the last few years, and I had noticed how many people had picked it up recently. You know, you couldn't throw a stone without finding somebody who was knitting. So it was really big in that kind of mid 2000s. So as I was starting to look into that, I realized, oh my gosh, no one's done any research on this area. That's so weird. How could that not have occurred? So that was really where I wanted to put my thesis efforts, was like, I want to know why people want to knit again. Like, what's up with that? So that's when you and I got together. I stalked you outside your office for many a week before I could get up the nerve to be like, please be my advisor. But yeah, so I did my thesis project on that. And that was super duper fun. Also, while I was there, I spent a lot of time with Dr. Ogle, Jen Ogle. I took her social psych course, which was fantastic. I learned so much. It was like every week I would go home and I'd be like explosions in my brain of all these new things I had learned. And I was like, oh, whoa, everything is different now that I know this. So loved that class. It was just so eye-opening. And when I got done with that degree, my initial plan was actually to go out and work in the industry for a while. I was thinking like, this might be a good time to get, you know, some industry experience. Like, I think I do want to go back and do like a PhD, but I don't know if I want to do it right now. I'm really young. And then I got an opportunity like, oh, wait, I can get this paid for. So I was like, all right, fine. I'll go do the PhD right now. Why not? So yeah, I did end up going to Oregon State. I liked their program. I actually went and toured it. It was one of the only schools I had ever actually toured before just showing up. Usually I would just send money and be like, okay, I'll be there in the fall. Don't worry. But I actually went and saw, I got to speak with Leslie Barnes, and she talked to me about their program and kind of what they did. And I was like, this seems like a really good fit. It's pretty close to home, so I could actually go for a visit. So I'm going to go there. And that was great. I had a really positive experience at Oregon State. I worked under Kathy Mullett, and Kathy and I were just peas in a pod, just very like over in the corner being dorky about design stuff. I learned so much from her about teaching and like how to teach and about pattern grading, which is still one of my dorky loves. I absolutely adore pattern grading and sizing. And my students don't know this yet, but I'm integrating a whole unit into their coursework this coming fall in pattern grading. I'm like, finally. So, yeah, it was a great time. I was getting really active in ITA. I actually served as the grad liaison my last year there. So that was really fun. I got to interact with the council, learned a lot through that process about just kind of the larger academic field and what's going on, and really like some of the backstory of where design used to be as this entertainment, not seen as scholarly, and to where it is today. So that was really helpful to me as well. I will also say while I was there, I did spend a couple of courses learning about fashion theory. So Elaine Peterson was there, and I learned a ton about theory and about publishing. You know, she was the editor of CTRJ at that time. So I spent a lot of time with her just learning about what does publishing mean? What does like good methods mean? And so that was also really foundational in my approach moving forward, and further cemented my love of theory, which had been fostered through my master's and just continued to grow. So yeah, as I was rounding out that educational activity, I had to figure out what I was going to do my dissertation on. And I really had trouble figuring out a topic. I had a lot of interests and I couldn't quite figure out what it should be. I had found this lady who was teaching spinning at a local yarn store, and I had signed up for it just because like I needed an outlet. I was super stressed and I was like, I'm going to learn to spin some yarn. That sounds amazing. So I'm spinning the yarn and I'm talking to this lady, and I found out she had these like designer sheep in her little tiny two acre pasture that she was growing and she was making all these blends of sheep wool. And I was like, this is so interesting and funky. And I'm going to do my dissertation on like consumer behavior of yarn and how that affects the like design process. So if your raw material changes, how does that affect what you can make? So that's where the inspiration for that whole project came from, was this interesting lady with her designer sheep teaching me how to spin yarn. So yeah, it was really fun. And I finished up there and it was like, okay, time for a job. I interviewed around and I came down here to LSU, and it really, initially I was like, I don't know about this. Will maybe be like a practice interview because I don't know if it's going to be a good fit. But I got here and I started talking to people and it was like, oh, okay, I can start to see some of these connections. I think this could actually work. And so I decided that this was going to be it. I came on down here and I've been down here for 10 years. So I guess I've localized by now.
That definitely does sound like you have localized with some of the projects that you have going on. And you know, thinking about that, the wild alligator, that's a very local
Yes. Plant
and animal. So would you talk to us about that? Because that is just fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was about 3 years ago, post-pandemic. I was sitting in my office working on some stuff, and I got a phone call, and I picked it up, and it was Matt Fannin from Ag Econ. He was like, hey, you don't know me, but my name is Matt, and I'm looking for someone who knows about crafting and might want to work on alligator leather. And I went, okay, I've got a background in local fiber and craft research. I'm probably the person you want to talk to. So we arranged a meeting, and come to find out, he had been doing research on alligator and wild alligator for Louisiana Department of Fish and Wildlife. And he was looking at the economic impact of the alligator to the state. What does alligator tourism do for a state? What does the meat production and the leather production do? And what he was telling me is initially the price for wild alligator was pretty darn high. So in 2018, the price per linear foot was like $25, $30. And today it's $7 if you can sell it. It's a major price slump, and it's going to very much affect the state economy. So I want to put together a project that looks at handcrafting as a potential market for wild alligator leather. I said, oh, that sounds really super cool. Let's like delve into that more. So we started talking about what's the difference between farm raised versus wild alligator, and how does that whole process work? So we have something called the Alligator Management Program. So back in the day, alligators were actually pretty close to endangered. They had been way overhunted. And so the government stepped in, and what they ended up doing was creating this program where farmers go out into the wild, they get eggs from the alligators, and they hatch them at the alligator farm, and they raise the alligators. So those are your farm-raised alligators. A lot of those are raised to a certain size, not too big. And they are sold specifically to the European luxury market. So for like watch straps, handbags, your Birkins, that's going to be from your farm-raised alligators. Legally, they have to put a certain amount of their farm-raised alligators, once they get big enough, out into the wild. So they have to release them to sustain that population so that those wild alligators, so they become wild, can make more eggs, so we have more alligators. However, you can't leave too many wild alligators, an apex predator, in the wild. Not good, because they're going to eventually become a nuisance gator, potentially, where they are eating pets or getting onto golf courses. Sort of some of those images you think about when you think about Florida. Yeah, they then have a tagging system where people who have property with alligators on it can get X amount of tags for hunting alligators. The skins that come from those wild alligators are going to generally be larger, and they're going to tend to have more flaws to them. So they actually will go through and grade all alligator skins, and they can assign the best skins are going to be a grade 1, the worst skins grade 5. And it's just depending on how many flaws they have. So, you know, bigger gators are out there fighting in the wild, so they're going to get scratches and holes and stuff in their skins. I mean, that's just the nature of things. So what we wanted to do was try to get crafters interested in buying wild alligator leather. It's a little cheaper. It's got flaws. They're probably not going to be as worried about it as, say, your European luxury market. So as we start to develop this project, we're thinking we could make like craft kits because kits are really hot. People are very interested in making things, but it's sometimes hard for them to get all the supplies they need. So we can make leather crafting craft kits with alligator leather. That sounds super cool. What we wanted to do was then figure out, well, how much are the consumers willing to pay for the alligator leather if they have another choice? So like alligator versus cowhide, what's the price premium? What are they willing to pay extra for alligator over cow? Or are they willing to pay extra for scars? Or are they going to pay less? So we started looking at characteristics like that. And for us to actually put some number values to that, we actually went and found a third partner, Dr. Jared Penn, who's also an ag econ. And he is a discrete choice experiment guy. So he's really into consumer behavior, and his method of choice is called a discrete choice experiment. You show people choices and then they will choose which option they want. And you can actually start to assign values to various characteristics. It's super interesting, and it actually gets beyond this whole willing or this like purchase intent that we really like in our research within our field. He actually goes deeper and can get price values on things. I'm very excited about reporting this research to our field so that hopefully some of our merchandisers can get onto this technique because it's really amazing. But yeah, we started doing that project. We put together our craft kits. It took us about a year. We made about 400 of them. So we were mass producing them. My grad student, Lauren, has been really wonderful. She's gone through and cut them all and assembled them all. She's basically made a little workshop upstairs. And then we started running our experiment. We first tried it in person, and we have a survey that people have to take, and then we actually give them a kit when they're done. We found out that the survey just was really long for people in person, so we actually had to move to online. But once we got it online and through multiple iterations, way more than I've ever done in my research career, we tweaked that survey like 6 or 7 times. And we had even had focus groups before that. So it was really fascinating to learn like a different research approach than what we do in our field. But yeah, we're just finishing that up, and we're going to actually start reporting some of the results very shortly.
Oh, that is just fascinating. And several thoughts come from that. So many people don't link the connection between fashion and apparel design with the ag industry. And my background, I come from an ag industry. But would you talk about that more? Because I think, you know, there's some of our listeners that'll be surprised that, especially if you articulated so well the economic factors, some of the societal factors, and then plus the consumer factors within ag that you and your collaborators are looking at.
Absolutely. So I actually wanted a job within a college of ag. That was something I was looking for specifically. I have the 4-H background. I can see the connections between local fibers and textile products, and especially the idea of like reshoring, bringing production back, slow fashion, all these sorts of things really do relate to fiber, which if you're doing it in a very like local, sustainable way, should be coming from your area. So I think there's definitely a lot of opportunity. We're hoping to actually take our alligator project into the ag tourism realm and look at tourist items. It's another avenue that really hasn't been explored. But yeah, in general, like, it's amazing how many people I will talk to and say, oh yeah, I'm over in the College of Ag. And they're like, why? What are you doing there? You should be in like design, or you should be in business. I'm like, the nice thing about being in ag is I get this connection to the fiber, which is important to my research. And really, there's this theme of like consumer behavior and sustainability that run throughout most of the colleges within, or most of the departments within our college. I think it actually is a really natural fit.
Oh, it is. It really is. And so thanks for that. And I love that you also brought up and tourism. You're my second guest I've interviewed this week that has discussed ag tourism. And that is something that probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I was exploring with some faculty about possibilities in ag tourism. And I think we're going to see a boom in that. So I think you are spot on that. So that's cool. Also, so do you see yourself scaling and selling the kits to a larger range of people? If I wanted to buy a kit or our audience wanted to buy a kit?
It may be something that could be approached at some point in time. We have had people ask us if they could buy one. We don't really know at this point in time. We're sitting on our extra inventory for use in that tourism study, but certainly it's something that could be thought about. I will say that I tend to be much more on the like research side of things. Like, I'm very excited about doing projects, but once they're done, I'm over them. I'm not super, oh, I'm going to turn this into a business. I just don't seem to have that kind of mentality that some of my colleagues do that are very like, oh, I'm turning my design into a business. I'm like, that's so cool. It's just not something I ever really, my brain just doesn't go there.
After this airs, you may have people that are interested in contacting you.
Yeah, you never know. They can hit up our website, our Go Gator website, and know how to do all this.
As you also talked about the connection with ag and apparel and fashion, you brought up sustainability and buying local fibers, sustainability. What have been some challenges and opportunities that you have encountered with having a sustainable focus in your design projects?
Oh, so sustainability is a really interesting one for me. When I was first coming up as like through grad school, sustainability was like everybody's focus. Everything was sustainability. And I was actually turned off by that because I was like, everyone's doing this. I don't want to do that. I want to do something totally different. So initially, I didn't want to be involved in sustainability. However, I fell into it because I was a broke grad student. So I started upcycling things because I knew I wanted wool, but I couldn't afford wool. So I was like, I'm going to go down to the thrift store and buy me some sweaters and boil them. So yeah, I was doing a lot of upcycling initially because I really wanted better fibers than my grad student budget would allow. So I started with that. And then I realized, oh, it's really fun and it's really challenging to like upcycle things. So I kept that as something that I continually do. I just did a denim upcycled project, which, you know, every designer has done something with denim, but there's so much of it and it's an interesting material to work with. I like it. So I was like, you know what? I think it's fun to do denim. I'm gonna go with that. But I've had some really fun opportunities with using some like sustainable approaches. I worked with Kelly Cobb last year. She used her textile shredder. So I had actually gotten this interesting call from the old governor's mansion here in Louisiana, called downtown Baton Rouge. They were like, hey, we have these old curtains and we don't know what to do with them. They're pretty cool. You want them for maybe a student project? I was like, totally. It's free fabric. Let me like drive my car down there. So they loaded up my car with these curtains and they were huge, like big, beautiful blue. I was really excited about them. I got them back here and they started just disintegrating. Like they had been sun damaged. And I was like, oh, darn it. What I was planning for these is definitely not going to work. I got this call from Kelly and she's, hey, let's collaborate on this. I was like, remember when we had that conversation about your textile shredder? I've got these curtains. So I sent her the curtains and she shredded them and felted them and made this cool fabric, sent it back to me, and I was able to work with that. Some of my sustainability things have really been also just like random luck or random people being like, hey, do you want this? And my answer is always going to be yes. Even if it's like maybe not going to work for what I initially hoped, I want to at least see it.
And I love that you're collaborating with faculty and other institutions, because you know, Kelly Cobb is at University of Delaware. And so that's quite a distance. And so that is fabulous that you've worked that out to collaborate on design projects together?
Yeah, I think collaboration has really been one of the cornerstones of like how I've approached things. It was forced on me. I was the only apparel designer here for quite a while. I was like, okay, I'm here by myself. Who am I going to work with? So I had to look outside of my university, which was actually really beneficial. I had to find mentorship at other schools. I'm sure I bothered you pre-tenure. I remember I had this really random meeting for ITA. And afterwards, I was like, I am getting mixed messages on what I need to do for grant writing. And I had heard Jungha Brickshire talking about grants a lot. And I was like, I sent her this email. I was like, can I just talk to you for a little bit about grants and like what I should be doing? And she was so sweet. And she was like, yeah, give me a call. We had this whole great meeting and she gave me some direction so I wasn't just like floundering. So I feel like I have had to collaborate with so many people, and people have always been really nice and kind with their time and willing to give me their opinions or work with me over the years. And I do try to pay that forward. I get a lot of really random calls. I'm like, yeah, I actually got an email from a girl in the UK a couple months ago asking about this body scanning project one of my students had done. I sent her some people to check out, some sources, because we don't help each other. It's no one's going to grow. So yeah, I think collaborating is super fun. It's interesting. I've been collaborating with a group of zero waste designers for the last 4 years. And we'll talk about that more, I know, at some point in time. But that's been a really fun challenge. We're all at different institutions and we've just figured out a way to get on Zoom and text each other about what we're doing. And every now and then we'll just get this weird picture like, here's my pattern and it's weird, help me. And we're all shooting ideas at each other. So I think it's really enriching as a designer.
I agree with you. And it's an evolution of our academic discipline that I'm so proud to see, because earlier on in my career within our discipline, that was not happening. People were not collaborating, even within their own institutions, if there was more than one design educator. And so it's really wonderful. And your generation of academics are really doing it well. And so kudos. And we do have such great knowledge in the discipline, and people are nice and realize the benefits of helping each other out. It doesn't hurt you.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the main thing. It's you can't do everything yourself. It's impossible and it's boring. Like, you might as well work with other people. It's way more fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, technology has been a big part of your work. And you know, you have this fascinating wearable technology project with exoskeletons. Would you talk about that?
Sure. So yeah, when LSU News Brief, they send these out about what's going on in research. And there was this little blurb about these construction management professors, and they had developed an exoskeleton prototype backpack thing that was going to help support, I think it was like spinal movement. And I was looking at it, I was like, that's cool. That's interesting. And I was like, I wonder if they think about sizing and sizes of bodies and how that could affect the exoskeleton. And I guess I had just drank a lot of coffee that morning. So I sent him an email. I was like, hey, your project's neat, but have you ever thought about working with an apparel designer? Because we know a lot about like the human body and how to put stuff on the body. And they were, okay, your email's weird. See you later. they brushed me off. Thanks for the idea. That's whatever. And so a couple months went by and I was just bopping along doing my own thing. And I got this email from Chao Wang, who's the PI of that project. And he was like, hey, remember when you sent us that email about collaborating? I think we should. I've got an NSF grant I'm working on and I want to put you on it. And I was like, okay, that sounds cool. Let's have a Zoom meeting. By the way, I want to bring my colleague who's like a functional design kind of wearables body scanning person. And her name's Sabe. And he was like, all right, awesome. So we got on a meeting and basically, they showed us that they were going to do this leg assist wearable exoskeleton for female construction workers. There's a lot of data about the growing need for more construction workers. and the amount of injuries that happen within the construction site. And there's almost no research on female construction workers. And having a background in apparel design, we know a lot about female bodies and how much different they are if you're just looking at body shapes. And so we're just getting really excited about like the sizing and grading and all that sort of fit component implications. And they're over there getting super excited about machine learning. So with our powers combined, we are doing the wearable exoskeleton.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Again, what an amazing collaboration. Again, that's so important to answer the big questions that and provide solutions to those big problems out there. Where, how far along are you in this project?
So it took quite a while to get them here, and then they had to do a lot of just initial programming. And now we are working on prototypes. My grad student's really diving in on that, and she's been fantastic. So yeah, we're working on prototypes now, and we're hoping to do some wear trials next year. They actually have, I call it the Mario Lab. They have a little lab there to with like ladders and little things to jump on. So we're going to put the exoskeleton on people and make them do the Mario Lab so we can see if the design is ergonomically appropriate.
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness. Is there a website for that research project?
I think there will be eventually, but not at this stage. We're pretty initial. But yeah, there'll definitely be stuff within ITA once we get a little closer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that'll be great. That'll be great. Yeah. As an educator, our audience can really see that you have a range of projects that you're working on. And then you also teach a range of courses, too. Would you talk about the types of courses you teach and what you find rewarding with these projects?
Yeah.
For a generation of designers?
Yeah. Within the courses, I tend to teach more of the upper division studios. My colleague, Donna Sapp, is really good at teaching the intro labs, the intro sewing courses. She's really gifted at it, and she has much more patience for that than I do. I can only show someone how to thread that machine so many times before I'm starting to be like, but no, flat pattern is definitely my favorite. I will fight people to teach flat pattern because I want it taught a very specific way. I'm a big fan of, I'm going to do it up here on the board. You're going to do it in front of you. Cut that paper, tape it up. Like, we're going to do it. And then you're going to make a bunch of garments. And some of them may not turn out the way you want, but that's okay because you got to just start learning. And the best way to learn is by doing it. Just do a bunch of it. Some of it's going to be bad. Some of it's going to be good. That's my major approach within the design area. And I teach the couture embellishments course, and I used to teach striping, but we were actually moving that. Now I'm going to teach a collection development type course, which will be fun. And that's going to be just a lot of like creative exploration, really trying to get them to dig deep on what is your idea? Why is it interesting? What does it mean? Let's put some theory in here. Let's put some trend research, really trying to get past that initial, I saw this at Forever 21 and it's really cute and ta-da. So that's definitely my approach within the design. Other classes that I teach, a graduate social psych course. So a lot of that theory and why consumers buy things, that sort of stuff in that class.
Wonderful. Would you tell us a little bit more about the couture embellishments course and some of the techniques and what you do in there?
Yeah, sure. So our couture embellishments course is interesting. We can change the focus of it depending on who's teaching it. We try to make it flexible depending on our schedules. But we do a lot of work on what are fabrics, what does it mean to underline with organza versus underline with muslin versus underline with flannel. So looking at that, looking at structure, looking at, okay, your mind will put a corset into something like this is what it means to put bones in. This is a waist stay. Let's go through all these components and put them together. And then we get into a lot of handwork. So we look at silk ribbon, dyeing, knitting. Sometimes if my textile printer isn't acting up, we'll do some textile printing. So it really just depends on also somewhat of the interest of the class. So with that class, because it is, in my mind, a bonus design course, I want those students to be able to direct themselves a little bit. When I'm teaching, I always envision this idea of like, my flat pattern students have to do what I want them to do. My upper division students get much more freedom because they need to start growing into where their career path is going to be or what they want to be as a designer. I don't want to force someone to, you're like a sportswear designer. I'm not going to be like, hey, no, you got to go do over this. So trying to leave a little more flexibility and then also gauging what the group is interested in. So here's a list of 10 things, rate your top five.
And would you also dig into your graduate course a bit more in the social psychology aspect of dress?
Yeah. So that class, it is a little bit like fashion studies and so she's had a baby, because I want them to get some of those seminal works. And even if we don't read all of them, because there's just not enough time, we're definitely going to touch on them. And it might be like, okay, this one is talking a lot about Simmel. This is who Simmel is, and this is why we care. Or now we're going to read about Foucault, but we're not actually going to read Foucault because we don't have enough time, but this is what this means. So trying to give them background in those key theorists is really important to me. We do touch on a lot of topics in that class. We do costume and how it relates to everyday life. And we do ethnic dress and body image. Let's see here. I just added one on plastic surgery. So we did a whole plastic surgery day. Well, yeah. So we definitely try to touch on a lot of topics, read multiple articles for each class. Let's see. Once I do that for the term project, each of those students actually gets to conduct a ethnography. So I let them choose their topics or their topic, where they're going to find their data, what are they going to collect. They actually analyze it and write a research paper. I definitely don't like making my grad students spin their wheels. That drives me bananas. So if you're going to put the work in, it's going to be publishable. So all of my grad classes are structured so that if you're in my design class as a grad student, you can get an ITA entry out of your piece, and you should. By the way, I'm making you write the abstract. And then this one, it's, here's your 16-page paper. It's ready for submission. That's the goal. So definitely a lot of hard work. I require a lot out of them, but I think that's a good thing. That was at CSU, that was how you guys trained us. You didn't have a PhD, so you made the master students work like PhD students, which was great. I just feel the same way. Like, project better be good enough to be published.
That has been said.
It's a good thing. I think it's a great thing.
I love that you're helping your students work smart. If they're doing something, then it has an outcome, and that is so smart. Now, since you brought up Colorado State, I just want us to go back a few years to your master's thesis and talk a little bit more about that, because as you mentioned, there weren't projects that really discussed knitwear and the motivations for that and why people were knitting and that resurgence that was happening after 9/11, many F types of areas. And you also have a publication from your master's thesis, and oftentimes that does not happen. And it's been one that has been read and cited quite a bit. So would you talk a little bit more about your master's thesis?
Sure. So I knew I wanted to do something on knitting. And initially I thought I was going to do knit designs, but it was as I was starting to try to look for research on the topic, there was just nothing. And I was like, oh no. And I remember telling Dr. Luttrell, I can't write articles. This is so bad. And she was like, you could think of it as bad, or you could think of it as an opportunity. That's really where the initial idea came from. I can see this trend. There's a whole commercial aspect going on. This is really at that height of that Stitch and Bitch movement. People were like bringing knitting to the baseball games. That was a whole thing. So it was really at the height. And I was like, this sounds really interesting. I want to know the motivations of these young knitters. Like, why do they like knitting? What's motivating them? So when I was starting that project, I knew I wanted to look at young people specifically because a lot of them were learning in new ways, like they were learning through the internet or through friends. It wasn't that traditional, like my mom taught me kind of thing. And that's really where that idea had spawned from. And I'm sure we had lots of conversations about it and what we had seen as knitters going on. And it was really a great place to do it in Fort Collins because the Interweave Press is there. There were like 3 yarn shops there. So it was really into that craze at the point that I did that research. So yeah, I was able to interview 15 young, I don't remember exactly how I defined young anymore, probably below 30. Oh no, I'm out of young now. But yeah, I interviewed these ladies and talked to them about like why they liked knitting, what was it that was interesting to them about it. And a lot of them were into the creative aspect, and some people did it for stress relief. No, everybody did it for stress relief. That's right. But some people were doing it because they liked the math aspect of it. So there was multiple reasons that people approached that. But yeah, it was definitely a really fun little project. I remember writing the article off of it, or writing that initial manuscript was so hard. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just like, oh, I'm going to try. I remember at one point I sent it to you because I was like, I don't even know how to like do this. What am I doing? So it took a while to get that through. And I remember, and if anyone is still listening at this point, the first set of like comments I got back on that was 12 pages long. That is 12 pages of things that were wrong with that article. So what I want people to know is you got to just be willing to put yourself out there and be told, like, this is bad for all these reasons. Like, you got to get a thick skin because nothing is good at the first go around. Okay, nothing. So you might as well just get that out of your brain. But yeah, we worked it through. We got that second revision, and I think it was still major revisions, and I got it through again. And eventually it came out, and I was so proud of that. I was like, I think it came out within like the second week that I was here at LSU. Cause I remember I was having lunch. We used to have lunch together and my department head was there. And I was like, oh my gosh, I finally got my thesis. And you see here, Jane, I'm so excited. You got to just keep trying. I think that's the main thing when it comes to publishing your research is they're going to tell you it's bad. And what you got to do, and Dr. Burns taught us this, and I think it was a really great chunk of advice. You read the comments, you get mad, and you don't look at it for a week. And then you come back and you start fixing it. But you got to take a week off because it's like painful. This is like your baby. You worked so hard on it and they hate it for so many reasons. So you got to take a week to get okay with it. And then you just come back in and eat the elephant one bite at a time.
Oh, that's such great advice. And one quality of yours I've always appreciated is your perseverance and that just keep at it. If someone is not supportive or if you have a roadblock, you just keep going. And I've always, always admired that in you. And I do also want to address your comment about your thesis where you said it was a little project.
Well, I call them all.
It was a big project. It was a big project with big impact. Uh-huh. And again, not everyone has their master's thesis published. That is rare oftentimes. And then also, it's really well cited. And it's been fun to be with you on that journey, too. And I forgot that it was 12 pages of comments.
Yeah. Yeah. I make sure I tell all my students, I have big fan of you got to keep yourself humble situation. Don't get this giant ego. It's completely, don't have that. I actually have a copy of an early paper I wrote in grad school and all the comments I got on it. It's bleeding red. And every now and then I just pull that out and show that to a student. I'm like, look, this is where I started. So that's okay. Like, it's fine. You're going to be told that your paper is bad a lot. Just get used to it. You're going to be told your grant is not good. You're going to be told like your design is not read and therefore not good enough. So it's just someone's opinion. You just keep plugging away, fix it what the best you can, put some band-aids on it and put it back in.
Oh, that is great advice for everyone. You know, regardless of what discipline, field, if you're going into industry or going into academia, you're going to get feedback. And yeah. Do you have any other advice for our audience out there? You have so many great experiences.
I think another really important thing for people to consider is just to be open to failure. I think I'm seeing a lot of that with this younger generation in my classes. They're very scared. They're very like, I'm very hesitant about poking on a button that I might not. I'm like, just poke around until you find something. Like, what's going to happen? What's the worst that could possibly happen? This idea of being open to failure to me is very important. I recently started doing basketry and it was like, I had no clue what I was doing when I first started. I was like, bought a basket kit on Etsy. I'm like, oh, make some baskets. It's going to be super cool. And the first one I made was such a failure. It was horrible. And it had all these weird things poking out. It was awful. And so I looked at it and I was like, this is obviously wrong. I've done something completely wrong. And so I got on YouTube, I watched some videos, and then I tried again. And I failed quite a few times before I got into a groove and figured out what I was doing. I'm going to go with, because I still fail a decent amount. But if you're not even willing to fail the first time, you're never going to do something interesting or cool. Why not? I feel like half of my collaborations, I'm sending weird emails to engineers being like, hey, you should collaborate with an apparel designer. Sure, that could have ended up really weird, but it was fine. Why not? I have conversations with people. Anytime I go to a college event or a university event, I'm chatting people up. I'm like, hey, what do you do? Oh, cool. You study mosquitoes? That's really neat. I study clothing. Hey, maybe we could make some kind of really cool mosquito thing. Like, so I just had that conversation not that long ago with this entomology professor that I was like, hey, maybe we should collaborate on a super mosquito clothes. But you, why not? So the worst thing they're going to do is say, oh, that's neat. See you later. And then you just move on.
Well, I think for a big question I have in life is failure really failure? Or is it just, what is failure? And is it just that you're learning and maybe we should reevaluate what is failure? And
yeah,
that's really something. Because part of innovation is taking that risk. And if it doesn't quite work out like you intended, is that failure or is it a learning opportunity?
Yeah, that's super important. Like failure is just the inability to learn from something and why it went wrong. If you don't reflect and think about, dude, what happened here? Why did this totally, then you may have failed. But if you learn something from it, then I think you didn't fail.
I love that. I love that. Okay. That's the new definition of fail. Yes. Credited to Dr. Stannard. Our question that we ask every one of our guests is, how do you define innovation?
Okay, so this was one that was really tricky for me. I was like, okay, how do I define innovation? I looked around at some definitions, trying to like, maybe I could piggyback off of somebody really good and profound. But in the end, I'm not really that like super profound person. I think in the end, you've got to really just stick with this idea of you need to be in a space where you are open to trying new things and open to failure. That's really important. And you just need to be willing to like try. If you aren't trying new things, if you aren't trying to collaborate with new people, build new, strange, cross-disciplinary approaches to problems, then you really have no chance of innovating. So that's really my main formula, is be open to ideas and be open to failure and hopefully learn from your failures.
Oh, that's a wonderful definition. That is just wonderful. Thank you for being here today. So appreciate you. Heartfelt thank you to Dr. Casey Stannard for taking us through this journey of her work as an apparel designer, working in sustainability, textile arts and crafts, and collaborating with a variety of disciplines and people on campus, off campus. Your journey really has been a way for us to think about innovation in a different way. And you're pioneering research in areas that are going to impact future generations. And thank you so much. To our listeners, we really hope that today's episode has inspired you to look at the clothing that you're wearing and fashion and brings you a new light in recognizing creativity, sustainability, the social impact that fabrics and apparel make in your life. Remember, innovation isn't just about the next big tech project or breakthrough. It's also about the subtle shifts that we create and perceive and interact with the objects that are in our everyday lives. So thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery and insight. Don't forget to subscribe to Innovation Insights podcast on your favorite platform to stay up to date and explore new opportunities that's shaping our days every day. So remember to follow us and watch for more leaders such as Dr. Stannard. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Dr. Yolanda Sanders. I'm signing off until next time. Keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.